Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, the H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you Information, Please, presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman.
Thank you. Information, Please, tonight is broadcasting from the stage of the Mosque Theater in Newark, New Jersey. And each person here has secured admission by purchasing a bond of from $50 to $5,000. 3,277 people have purchased bonds to the tune of $2,398,975. But in addition, 188 seats are occupied by representatives of local business concerns who have subscribed the sum of $275 million. And quick mathematicians will see that this makes a grand total, and we mean grand, of $277,398,975. We think it safe to say that this sum represents the largest total ever subscribed in the course of a single appearance by any group. We think Newark has given the country a record-breaking mark to shoot at. Now, we don't want to brag, but you might like to hear Information Please's total for its entire bond tour to date. Here it is. $680,554,515. And now, back to our unrehearsed program, the experts tonight being our trio, Oscar Levant, Franklin P. Adams, and John Kieran of the New York Sun, and our guest, the celebrated congressman from Arkansas, whose post-war peace resolution was adopted in Congress this week, the Honorable James W. Fulbright. But, ladies and gentlemen, before we begin, we're going to hear from a surprise guest on this platform. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fadiman. You know, I had hoped to have the pleasure of appearing as a guest tonight on this program, but an emergency came up and I had to beg off. And then the emergency passed away, and tonight I have the even greater pleasure of listening to Congressman Fulbright as he occupies what otherwise would have been my anxious seat. You've heard the truly magnificent totals just announced by Mr. Fadiman. This particular bond drive is a glorious success. The common man is putting his back into the war. He is buying 50% more bonds this year than he did last year, and he is going to do still better. He must do better so as to put our armies in Berlin and Tokyo as soon as possible. He must do better if we are to have a stable peace without inflation. In this Information Please program, I hope there will be questions about peace. The common men of the world are thinking about peace and are determined that this time there shall not be another Versailles Treaty. Nor do they want any part in any partial alliance which will lead inevitably to World War Number 3. They are out both to win the war and the peace, and they mean business. That is why this bond drive and all future bond drives will be a success. But God help us, if the common man is deceived into a false and a temporary peace.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. And now for our first question, which comes to us from Jane Wheelock of Orange in the sovereign state of New Jersey. This is a question about New Jersey, gentlemen, and heaven help you if you don't get it right. Name a resident of New Jersey who achieved the highest rank in each of these fields. First, in the field of government, a resident of New Jersey who achieved the highest rank, Mr. Fulbright.
Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson, yes. Became president. And what rank did he occupy in the state of New Jersey, Mr. Fulbright?
He had been governor.
He had been governor. And before that?
President of Princeton.
Yes. What resident in New Jersey achieved the highest rank in the field of sports? In the field of sports. Mr. Levant.
Mickey Walker didn't do bad. champion of the world.
Yes, in what division?
In the middleweight division.
Yes, there is supposedly a division that at least gets more attention than that. I don't know whether Mr.
Oh, Adams. Another welterweight, Red Cochran.
Was he a New Jerseyite?
He's a welterweight champion of the world. Pro-tem.
Mr. Kieran, is there any other?
Well, I suppose there's a lot, but they don't come to mind right at the moment.
Moberg didn't do bad either.
No champion.
not a champion. James J. Braddock was the champion.
Oh, yes,
champion.
Sure.
And, of course, he came from not far from this district, from North Bergen, New Jersey. How about a resident of New Jersey who achieved high rank in the field of applied science? Mr. Fulbright.
Mr. Edison.
Yes, quite right. And what part of New Jersey did he do his work in? Mr. Adams?
Oh,
Menlo Park.
Menlo Park, yes. Thomas Alva Edison, the wizard of Menlo Park. Well, I guess that gets you gentlemen by for the New Jersey question. How about...
No, they had a vice president from New Jersey once.
Yeah, I know that.
What one?
Garrett A. Hobart.
Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr?
Yeah.
His father was the president of Princeton, I remember.
He was a vice president.
He was a vice president. Yeah. That's true. I suppose he was a resident of New Jersey, yes. How about this one from Catherine Hurl of New York City? Quote the context in which these thoughts on freedom appear. I'm going to give you several short quotations about freedom and liberty. See if you can tell me where they come from. The first is, the blessings of liberty. The blessings of liberty, Mr. Kieran.
It's the preamble to the Constitution of the United States.
Yes. Would you care to give us
to secure part of it? For ourselves the blessings of liberty and... Well, I can't give you the whole thing.
It is a tough one. Mr. Fulbright, does the preamble come to your mind, the beginning of it?
We, in order to establish him...
Mr. Adams? Mr. Kieran, want
to
try?
In order to establish...
That's right. We the people of the United States.
I'll try Mr. Kieran again.
No, never mind. Let it go.
Well, I have a feeling we ought to remember that. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, secure domestic tranquility... Provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Now, how about this one, gentlemen? Liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead. Where was that said? Under what circumstances? Liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead. Well, it's from the third act, first scene of what play?
Julius Caesar.
Julius Caesar, yes. Quite right, Mr. Kieran. What happens in that scene?
Why, they just gave the business to J. Caius Caesar.
Yeah. Gave it to him at the end of a knife. And who is it that says these words?
The mob.
Well, a particular man, I think, says it,
well,
isn't it?
Well, that would be the leader of the conspirators.
Cinna?
Oh, Cinna the conspirator.
Yes, Cinna is the one that says it. I don't think I can give you full credit, Mr. Kieran. I kind of threw that in your lap. How about this one? Proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Where does it come from? Proclaim liberty throughout all the land, Mr. Kieran.
It comes from a bell with a crack in it, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia.
Yes, and before those words appeared on the Liberty Bell, where else did they appear? The words go back a long way.
Maybe to the Bible.
Yes, quite right, Mr. Kieran. It goes back to Leviticus. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. You see, it's a very old as well as a very good idea. How about this one from Benjamin Tereskin of New York? Who were these prophets of recent times who weren't listened to? These are Cassandras whom we should have listened to but didn't. Now, the first one tried to warn America of the Japanese menace. This was some time ago. Mr. Fulbright?
You mean Mr. Ambassador Grew?
Well, I was thinking of
Homer Lee
before,
in
that.
1909.
Who did?
Homer Lee in
Who was Homer Lee, Mr. Fulbright?
He was a man born in Colorado. He became a general in the Chinese Army.
Yes. Where did he warn us? In what book?
The Valor of Ignorance.
Yes, recently republished, but we paid no attention. Mr. Levant?
I know one you don't know. A very important one was Admiral Taussig, I think, who was demoted out of the Navy, if you recall, about a year before the attack.
No, I don't know that.
I may be wrong, and I may be inflammable, and I'm wrong.
No, you may be right.
I think I'm right, yeah.
I think you are right, and if it isn't Admiral Taussig, it is certainly another famous admiral, Admiral Mahan. In the problem of Asia, who warned us of the Japanese menace.
It was
now, who tried to warn England of the German menace and wasn't listened to? Mr. Levant.
Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill, yes.
1934.
Yes, he will always be remembered for that. How about one who tried to warn Europe of the fascist menace? Warned all Europe of the fascist menace a long time ago.
Hitler.
That's a very good answer. That's a very good answer.
Well, he wasn't shy about it.
No, he wasn't shy about it. It was we that paid no attention to him. But there was someone on the other side who warned Europe of the fascist menace, and that was Ambassador...
Sal Vimini.
Who?
Pardon?
Mr. Fulbright?
Well, the ambassador in Berlin, Messerschmitt, warned us.
Warned us, yes, but I think the one who was most vocal and who hit the nail on the head most frequently was who?
The one who had a diary. Dodd.
Before him, Litvinov, again and again at various meetings of the League of Nations. Litvinov. Well, we did get 2 out of 3 on that. Try this one from Everett H. Perkins of Bantam, Connecticut. This, gentleman, is a very light question. I'm going to ask you to help a tailor make a man's suit by quoting lines that mention 4 parts of the suit. Any lines of poetry or a song that mention any part of a suit, Mr. Levant?
Vesta la Juba, an old gag.
Well, it's new on this show.
Vesta! Well, I think I have to pay for singer.
I think so, yes. Petrillo will get after you. Mr. Adams?
To knit up the raveled sleeve of care.
Very good. From whom is that?
Shakespeare, but it isn't a sleeve like that.
Different kind of sleeve. It's from Macbeth. That gives us a sleeve and a vest. Let's just see if we can get 2 more articles of clothing, Mr. Levant.
Look for the silver lining.
That's very pretty, yes. Very good. Mr. Kieran?
As the heart pants for water.
Wow.
Mr. Adams?
Shoe fly, don't bother me.
That's another one? Maybe. I think we'd better end this by saying hick jacket, Mr. Adams. Try this one from Rufus R. Reynolds, Jr. of War Trace, Tennessee. This is a musical question, gentlemen. 3 selections going to be played on the piano. In each case, it should suggest to you someone who dies to this music. Let's have the first.
I'm dying.
Mr. Levant?
Aza's Toad from Peer Gynt by Edvard Grieg.
That's quite right. Did any of you other gentlemen even come within whispering distance of that? Let's have the second one. Mr. Levant had his hand up at once.
That's the Liebestod from Tristan.
Who does the dying there?
The girl first. Yes. Isolde.
Isolde, and Tristan follows her.
Sure, it's even there.
It's the longest death.
It's very beautiful, even those 2 bars. I'm sorry.
You like it?
Sure, I like it.
All right, you can have it. Now, how about the third and last? Mr. Levant again.
Oh, Prairie. Whoever sings that song's dying. The cowboy on the Lone Prairie.
Yes, the dying cowboy, bury me not on the Lone Prairie. Well, Mr. Levant came through with flying colors. You gentlemen should be ashamed of yourself. And now here's our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer, with some fine down-to-earth information for you.
I'm thinking about those green tomatoes in your victory garden. Now, you don't want to let the frost get them. No, sir, bring them in. And then, how about having fried green tomatoes for lunch or supper? Now, there's a good old-fashioned dish like Granddad used to dote on. And you don't need any ration stamps, either. Just brown, good, thick slices of green tomatoes and bacon drippings. Put them on a slice of bread or toast. Then, slowly pour on a little of that rich, red-brown and racy Heinz 57 sauce. It's one of the tastiest condiments that anybody has ever concocted. It's wonderful. The body and richness, the spice and the tang you get from Heinz 57 sauce. A lot of fine ingredients go into the making of that sauce. Tropical fruits and rare seasonings. Apples, raisins, onions. Heinz's own vintage vinegar. Pedigreed tomatoes. Heinz 57 sauce is a blessing to rationed meals. It stretches meat, adds extra flavor. It can help make a plain, wartime meal a joy to sit down to.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. Now we'll go on with a question from William E. McGlynn of Niagara University, Niagara County, New York. I want you to identify the dancers from the following lines of poetry or song. Each of these lines of poetry refers to the dance. The first is, on with the dance. A phrase we all know, Mr. Adams.
Let joy be unconfined.
That's how it ends, but what dancers are being referred to in that line? Mr. Kieran?
They were the dancers Belgium's capital the night before the Battle of Waterloo.
That's right.
That's right.
They were military men and their wives, and they were disturbed by the cannon's
waltzing.
Opening roar.
Yes, or as Byron puts it, the beauty and chivalry had gathered. Belgium's capital had gathered then her beauty and her chivalry. That's right. Now, here's another line about a dance. Will you join the dance? Will you join the dance? Mr. Kieran?
That was the walrus and the carpenter, I think, inviting the oysters to join the dance.
You think you've got your animals
Alice,
a bit mixed
up. No, wait a minute. The fish.
The whiting and the snail.
Yeah, that's it, the fish.
Yes, it was the whiting and the snail.
And mock turtle.
No, just the whiting and the snail. Will you, won't you, will you, won't you, will you join the dance? The whiting and the snail is the only right answer. I have to count that wrong, Mr. Kieran, because Mr. Adams came in just after you. And how about this one? Dance, dance, dance. Mr. Levant.
Dance, 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 little lady, so obsessed, da-da-da-da, I'm possessed, no coward.
No coward, yes. The little lady from an old coward song. That's very good. That gives us 2 out of 3. And
you left out the best one. Well, shall we dance? Groucho Marx.
That is a good one. Shall we dance? How about this one from George Killenberg of St. Louis, Missouri? Under what circumstances can the following things happen? Under what circumstances can the House of Representatives hold up a treaty? Under what circumstances can the House of Representatives hold up a treaty? Mr. Kieran.
Well, one way they could do it would be if it required any appropriation of money to enforce the treaty, the House could refuse to appropriate the money.
When it involves the raising of money, as for any special... is there any special kind of appropriation?
Well,
when money is spent for what purpose?
Well, I don't know what for, but it's got to come through the House if it needs money.
Well, is that right, Mr. Fulbright?
That's correct.
That's quite right, particularly in the case of the purchase of land. For example, when we purchased Alaska, when that was under consideration, the House of Representatives held up the treaty.
Even if it meant money to buy a pen to sign the treaty, still
is that,
be good.
Is that right, Mr. Fulbright?
I might lend him a pen.
Now, under what circumstances can the President negotiate a treaty without senatorial ratification? We always think of treaties as having to be ratified by the Senate. Are there any exceptions, or is there any exception to that rule? Can the President negotiate a treaty, Mr. Fulbright?
Well, strictly speaking, a treaty that has been determined as such must be ratified, but similar treaties, that is, treaties dealing with foreign affairs, have 2 other ways, that is, by executive agreements or by joint resolution.
But is there any particular kind of treaty or pact in which the President can do all the negotiation practically himself? With the assistance of his advisors, of course. Trade pacts, isn't that true? Trade pacts, reciprocal agreements?
Well, but that it goes through Congress in the form of joint resolutions. That's what I was referring to.
Oh, I see. Well, is that just a form, the passage through,
it
through
was,
Congress?
It went through. It recently went through in the form of a joint resolution. That word treaty is misused very often here recently.
You mean that we shouldn't use the word treaty when we mean
because
pact?
There are 3 legal constitutional methods of affecting our foreign relations. They need not be treaties.
Would you like to tell us what those are?
stuff.
Well, one, the executive agreement without any further ratification usually relates to a very simple matter.
Yeah.
Usually doesn't affect any change of property or anything of that sort. The principal way, then, is the next way, a joint resolution passing both houses and signed by the president, which such as your trade treaties. And the best example of that was the admission of Texas to the Union.
Yeah.
That's an example which is very appropriate at this time, because there was taking in a sovereign state by something less than a treaty in the sense that the Senate thinks of it. And the final way is a formal treaty such as the Treaty of Versailles.
Mr. Adams, is that clear to you?
Utterly.
Well, then I guess it's clear to everybody. Under what circumstances can a state enter into an agreement or compact with another state? Under what circumstances can a state enter into an agreement or compact with another state?
You mean like New Jersey and Pennsylvania?
Yes, why not?
That's flirtatious, isn't it?
Well, I should think if it obtains the consent of Congress to do so. For example, suppose two states are negotiating about a common reservoir that might touch the boundaries of both. Would that be right, Mr. Fulbright?
Oh, I think so, but they do make many agreements such as with regard to licensing and so on without the consent of Congress.
Without the consent of Congress.
Affecting minor commercial matters, I think. Reciprocal rights on licenses, for example.
I should think that would be true, too. Well, that gives us at least 2 3/4 out of 3 and sends us on to this one from Edward Hirschfield of New York City. This is a very simple question, gentlemen. It has just one answer. What do these celebrities of various fields have in common? The first is Christopher Morley. The second, Elmer Davis. The third, Whizzer White. And the fourth, our honored guest, Representative Fulbright, Mr. Adams.
They're all Rhodes Scholars.
Yes, all were Rhodes Scholars. Did you know, were they...
I found that out coming over in the car tonight. I didn't know about Mr. James until tonight.
Oh, you didn't know that. Did you? You knew that all three of them were Rhodes Scholars, Mr. Fulbright?
Yes.
Were any of them in your time at Oxford?
No.
You left out Robert Taylor, a Yank at Oxford.
Right. You should have included him. Gentlemen, I think on this one, on the next one, I'm going to ask you to get 3 out of 3. It's not a very tough one. It's from Sam Cooper of New York City. I don't know whether any of you gentlemen ever used the Sears Roebuck catalog, but if you do, the articles listed in it are indexed alphabetically. Some of the headings are followed by an alphabetical list of items that are sort of indented. Now, I'm going to read you the items, and you're going to give me the proper heading. I'll explain what I mean by giving you an example. If you read these 3 items, animal, mouse, plumbing, they would all be under the head of what, Mr. Kieran?
Animal traps.
Traps, that's quite right. They'd all be under the general head of traps. That was just an example. You get no credit for that, Mr. Kieran. Awfully sorry. Now, here's another set of items. Baby, hot water, vacuum. All under what general heading, Mr. Kieran?
Bottle,
yes, quite right. Dog, fur, horse. All under what general rubric? Mr. Adams, don't you ever read the Sears Roebuck catalog?
No.
Mr. Kieran.
I might be collars. South Norwalk and buy it.
Dog collars, fur collars, horse collars.
Yes, that would be quite right. Now suppose you saw the headings kitchen, oyster, spading. Kitchen, oyster, spading, S-P-A-D-I-N-G. That would be about what kind of article? They'd all be under what general heading? Oh, come, gentlemen, they'd all be forks. Kitchen forks, oyster forks, spading forks. Very simple.
Ah.
I think that sends $57 in war bonds and stamps to Mr. Cooper and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And sends us on to a question from R.T. Catterall of Richmond, Virginia.
I never use that purpose.
I'm going to read you some imaginary headlines. With what events in Eastern or Central Europe might these cryptic headlines be identified? Let's get 2 out of 3. Suppose you saw the headline, Peter follows Paul. With what event in Eastern or Central Europe would you associate that idea, Mr. Fulbright?
Would that be the king of Yugoslavia following the regent Paul?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, the prince regent of Yugoslavia flies and the young king mounted the throne. That was in March 1941. Quite right, Mr. Fulbright. How about this? White becomes red again. What event might that suggest to you, Mr. Adams?
White Russia.
Well, how about fixing up the rest of the headline?
Well, it's now red.
Yes, the Russian army is re-entering White Russia. Quite right, the Red Army. How about fighters replace bombers? Fighters replace bombers, Mr. Fulbright?
Well, in the German and Luftwaffe now, they have discontinued practically the manufacture of bombers making all fighters.
Yes, at least we think so.
Well, that's generally accepted.
And we hope that it is true. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. Thank you very much, Mr. Fulbright. Now one from Wellington Potter of Rochester, New York. Do you ever read Mother Goose, Mr. Fulbright, in the course of your duties?
Not in many, many years.
You don't. Well, now here's your chance to get up on Mother Goose. To what character in Mother Goose might you give first aid in the following situations? First aid for contusions. Mr. Kieran.
Jack fell down and broke his crown, and if you could fix him up, and Jill, who came tumbling after.
Yes. We don't know whether Jill was hurt or not.
Yes, she was.
She was?
She got vinegar and brown paper, and that's pretty bad first aid, if I know anything about it.
Now, suppose it was a case of malnutrition. What character in Mother Goose would you give first aid for malnutrition, Mr. Levant?
The one who opened the cupboard and found it bare. Mother Hubbard. The dog.
The dog.
Well, the dog, yes. Yeah. Did you have another one in mind, Mr. Fulbright?
No, that's...
The children, also, of the old woman. Mr.
Lived in a shoe.
Yeah. Yes, how about that?
She whipped them, put them to bed.
Yes, what did she give them for food?
Ketchup.
That wouldn't be malnutrition.
She gave them no broth without any bread.
Gave them some broth without any bread. Oh, she gave them some broth without any bread. Don't make it too tough on them, Mr. Adams. To what character in Mother Goose might you give first aid for drowning? For drowning. Who drowned in Mother Goose? Mr. Adams?
Pussy.
What happened to her?
Ding dong bell, pussy's in the well.
And who put her in, Mr. Adams?
Little Tommy Green.
Well, who put her out, Mr. Adams?
Little Tommy Trout.
Good for you, Mr. Adams. Yes.
Have children.
Mr. Fulbright, don't your children read Mother Goose? Very good for them. You see, if your children read Mother Goose, you could be an expert on this program regularly. After the House of Representatives closed, you could come back and do an honest job with us over here. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3, and I guess that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Fulbright, for your cooperation tonight. This evening, the H.J. Heinz Company has paid out $57 in war bonds and stamps and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, next week, we'll be back in our New York studio with Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran, and we'll welcome as our special guests 2 famous sports experts, Red Barber and Bill Stern. Remember, send your questions with the correct answers to Information Please.